Chapter 21. The Belts. Inamin. Not a spotch of gray. Dungeon days. 1. Instead of going back the way we'd come, Aaron directed me down 3 different flights of stairs, walking behind me and occasionally giving me a tap with his limber stick. I felt like a cow being driven to a pen, which was ugly and humiliating. But at least I didn't feel that I was being driven to the slaughterhouse. I was number 31, after all, and thus valuable. I didn't know why, but an idea had begun to glimmer. 31 was a prime number, divisible only by 1 and itself. 32, though, that was divisible all the way down. We passed many doors along the way, most closed, a few either open or standing ajar. I heard no one inside these rooms. The feeling I got on our journey was one of desertion and dilapidation. There were the night soldiers, but I had an idea that the palace was otherwise not very populated. I had no idea where we were going, but at last I began to hear the sound of loud clattering machinery and a steady thudding drum like a heartbeat. By then, I was pretty sure we were even deeper than Deep Moline. The gas jets on the walls were increasingly far apart, and many were guttering. By the time we reached the end of the third staircase, by then the drum was very loud and the machinery even louder, most of the light was being provided by Aaron's blue aura. I raised my fist to beat on the door at the foot of the stairs, and hard. I didn't want another slash on the back of my neck from the hateful stick.
"Nah, nah," Aaron said in his strangely insectile voice. "Just open it."
I lifted the iron latch, pushed the door open, and was hit by a wall of sound and heat. Aaron prodded me inside. Sweat sprang out on my face and arms almost immediately. I found myself on a parapet, surrounded by a waist-high iron railing. The circular area below me looked like an exercise club in hell. At least 2 dozen gray men and women were speedwalking on treadmills, each with a noose around his or her neck. 3 night soldiers lounged against the stone walls, holding limber sticks and watching. Another was on a kind of podium, banging on a high wooden cylinder, like a conga drum. Painted on the drum were bleeding monarch butterflies, which was probably inaccurate. I don't think butterflies bleed. Directly across from me, beyond the treadmills, was a clattering machine, all fan belts and pistons. It shook on its platform. Above it was a single electric light, like the kind mechanics use to look under the hoods of the cars they're fixing. What I was seeing reminded me of the warboats in one of my favorite TCM movies, Ben-Hur. The men and women on those treadmills were slaves, just as the men rowing the warboats had been. As I watched, one of the women stumbled, clawed at the rope sinking into her neck, and managed to lunge to her feet again. 2 of the night soldiers watched her, then looked at each other and laughed.
"Wouldn't want to be down there, kitty, would you?"
Aaron asked from behind me. "No." I didn't know which was more horrible. The prisoners striding along at a brisk walk that was just short of a run, or the way 2 of the skeleton men had laughed when the woman lost her footing and began to choke. No, I wouldn't. I wondered how much juice that treadmill-powered rattletrap of a generator could put out. I was guessing not much. There had been electricity in the Lord High's apartments, but I hadn't seen it anywhere else. Only the gas jets, which didn't look in very good shape either. How long do they have to...
"The shift is 12 hours.
It wasn't hours, he said, but my mind again made the translation. I was hearing Empisarian. I was speaking it, and I was getting better at both. I probably wouldn't have been able to utter a slang term analogous to awesome sauce yet, but even that might come eventually.
unless they choke out. We keep a few in reserve for when that happens. Come on, kiddie, you've had your look. Time to leave.
I was glad to go, believe me. But before I turned away, the woman who had fallen glanced up at me. Her hair hung in sweaty clumps. Her face was being buried in knots and hills of gray flesh, but there was enough of her features left for me to see her despair. Did the sight of that despair make me as angry as the sight of the slaughtered mermaid? I'm not sure, because it all made me angry. A fair land had been turned foul, and this was the result. Whole people locked in a dungeon, sick people with nooses around their necks, forced to run on treadmills to provide electric lights for the Lord High, and perhaps a fortunate few others, one of whom was almost certainly the man or creature in charge. Flight Killer.
Be glad you're whole,
Aaron said.
At least for a little while. Then you may regret it.
Just for emphasis, he whipped me across the neck with his limber stick, reopening the cut there. 2. Someone, most likely Percy, our trustee/warder, had thrown a dirty blanket into the cell I shared with Hamie. I shook it out, dislodging a fair number of lice, ordinary size as far as I could tell, and sat down on it. Hamie was lying on his back, staring up at the ceiling. There was a scrape on his forehead, a crust of blood under his nose, and both of his knees were cut up. One of the cuts had sent runnels of blood down his left shin. "What happened to you?" I asked.
"Playtime," he said hollowly. "He ain't got the stuff," said Fremy from the next cell. He had a black eye.
"Never had it at all," said Stooks.
He had a bruise on his temple, but otherwise looked okay.
"Shut up, both of you,"
I called from across the way.
"Do for him if you draw him. Until then, leave him alone."
Fremy and Stooks subsided. I sat down with his back against the wall of his cell, staring sullenly between his knees at the floor. He had a gouge over one eye. From the other cells I could hear groans and the occasional stifled grunt of pain. One of the women was crying quietly. The door opened and Percy came in with a bucket swinging in the crook of one elbow. He paused to look at the gas jet that had fallen out of the wall. He set his bucket down and put the gas jet back in its jagged hole. This time it stayed. He took a wooden match from the pocket of his smock, scratched it on a stone block, and held it to the jet's little brass nipple. It flumped alight. I expected Fremy to offer a comment, but that fine fellow seemed all out of humorous remarks for the time being.
"Minimin,"
Percy said through the teardrop that had once been a mouth.
"Minimin. Minimin."
"I'll take some,"
I said. Percy handed him a small disc from his bucket. To me, it looked like a wooden nickel, as in the old saying about don't take any.
"And give some to the new boy. If he don't need it, useless does."
"Liniment?" I asked.
"What the fuck else?"
Iota began to spread some on the back of his wide neck.
"Eesh,"
Percy said to me.
"Eesh, why?"
I assumed he was telling the new boy to reach, so I stuck my hand through the bars. He dropped one of the wooden nickels into my hand.
"Thank you, Percy," I said.
He looked back at me. His expression might have been amazement. Maybe he'd never been thanked before, at least not in deep Moline. There was a thick smear of bad-smelling stuff on the wooden disc. I hunkered down next to Hamie and asked him where it hurt.
"Everywhere,"
he said, and tried to smile.
"What's the worst?"
Meanwhile, Percy was toting his bucket down the aisle between the cells, droning.
"Minimin. Minimin. Knees. Shoulders. Guts the worst, of course. But no liniment will help that.
He gasped when I rubbed the liniment into the scrapes on his knees, but sighed with relief when I did their backs and then his shoulders. I had gotten, and given, after-game massages during football season and knew where to dig in.
That's good, he said. Thank you.
He wasn't dirty, not too dirty, at least, not the way I still was. I couldn't help remembering Kellen shrieking, "Get him out, he's filthy," as I certainly was. My sojourn in Empis had been extremely active, including a sprawl in cemetery mud and my recent trip to the Belts, which had been as hot as a sauna.
I don't suppose there are showers in this place, are there?
Nah. There used to be running water in the team rooms, from when there was real games. But now there's just buckets. All cold water, but ow!
Sorry, you're all knotted up here on the back of your neck.
You can give yourself a horse bath after next playtime. That's what we call it. But for now, you'll have to live with it.
The way you look and the rest of them sound, it must be playing rough. Even I looks banged up.
You'll find out, Stook said.
But you won't like it,
Fremmy added. From down the corridor, someone began to cough.
Cover it!
One of the women yelled.
No one wants what you got, dummy!
The coughing continued.
3.
Sometime later, Percy returned with a cart filled with pieces of half-cooked chicken, which he tossed into the cells. I ate mine and half of Hamie's. Across from our cell, I dumped his bones down his shithole and shouted,
Shut up, the gang of you! I want to sleep.
There was a little more after-dinner talk between the cells in spite of this decree. Then it died to murmurs and finally ceased. So I guess the chicken really had been dinner, and this was nighttime. Not that there was any way to tell. Our barred windows never showed anything but unmitigated darkness. Sometimes we got steak, sometimes chicken, once in a while bony fillets of fish. Usually, but not always, there were carrots. No sweets, nothing that Percy couldn't fling through the bars, in other words. The meat was good, not the maggoty remains I would have expected in a dungeon, and the carrots were crunchy. They wanted us healthy, and we all were, except for Dommy, who had some sort of lung ailment, and Hamie, who never ate much, and complained of the bellyache when he did. Whether it was morning, noon, or night, the gas jets flared, but there were so few of them that Deep Malene existed in a kind of twilight that was disorienting and depressing. If I'd had a sense of time when I came in, I hadn't, I would have lost it after the first 24 or 36 hours. The places where Aaron had hit me with his limber stick stung and throbbed. I used the last of the liniment on them, and it helped a little. I wiped at my face and neck. Dirt came off in clumps. At some point, I slept and dreamed of Radar. She was loping along, young and strong, and surrounded by a cloud of orange and black butterflies. I don't know how long I was out, but when I woke up, the long room of cells was still quiet except for snores, the occasional fart, and Dommy's coughing. I got up and had a drink from the bucket, being careful to place my finger over the hole in the bottom of the tin cup. When I turned back to my blanket, I saw Hamie staring at me. The puffy circles under his eyes looked like bruises.
You don't have to protect me. I take that back. I'm for it no matter what. They toss me around like a bag of grain, and that's just playtime. What's it going to be like when the fair one comes around?
I don't know. I thought to ask him what the fair one was, but I had an idea it might be a blood sport tourney, like cage fighting. 32 was, as I'd already realized, divisible all the way down. As for playtime, practice. a run-up to the main event. There was something else I was more curious about. I met a boy and a man on my way to Lillimar. They were, you know, gray people.
Ain't they most of them? Amy said. Ever since Flight Killer came back from the Dark Well.
He smiled bitterly. There was a ton of backstory in that one sentence, and I wanted to know what it was, but for the time being, I stuck with the gray man who'd been hopping along on his crutch. They were coming from Seafront.
Where are they now?
Amy whispered without much interest.
And the man said something to me.
First, he called me Whole Man.
Well, ain't ya? Not a trace of gray to ya. Plenty of dirt, but no gray.
Then he said, which of 'em did your mother flip her skirts for to leave you fair of face? Do you have any idea what that means? Amy sat up and stared at me, wide-eyed.
Where in the name of every orange butterfly that ever flew did you come from?
Across from us, I grunted and shifted in his cell. Do you know what it means or not? He sighed.
Galleons ruled Empus since time out of mind. You know that much, don't you?
I flapped my hand for him to go on.
Thousands and thousands of years.
Again, it was like having two languages in my brain, meshing so perfectly they were almost one.
In a way, they still do, Amy said. Flight Killer, being who he is and all, if he is still a he and not turned into some creature from the well. But where the fuck was I?
The galleons.
They're gone now. That family tree has been chopped down. Although, some say, a few still live.
I knew that a few still did because I'd met three of them. I had no intention of telling Amy that.
But there was a time, even when my father's father still lived, when there was many of the galleon. Fair they were, male and female, as fair as the monarchs Flight Killers rooted out.
Well, he hadn't rooted all of them out, but I had no intention of telling him that either.
And they were randy.
He grinned, showing his teeth so strangely white and healthy in that haggard face.
You know what that means, don't you?
Yes.
The menfolk planted their seeds everywhere, not just here in Lillimar or the Citadel, but in Seafront, Deesk, Ullum, even the Green Isles beyond Ullum, they say.
He gave me a sly smile.
And the women folk weren't above a little adventure behind the door either, 'tis told. Randy men, randy women, and precious little rapin, for many common folk are happy to lay with king's blood royal. And you know what comes of that sort of sportin', don't you?
Babies, I said.
Babbies, just so. It's their blood, Charlie, that protects us from the grey. Who knows what prince or courtier or even the king himself laid down with my grammy or my great-grammy or even my mammy. And here I am, without a splotch of grey on me. There's I, that great ape of a man, without a splotch. Dommy and Black Tom without a splotch. Stooks and Fremy, Jaya and Eris, Double, Bolt, Doc Freed, all the rest. And you. You who don't know a shitting thing. It almost makes me wonder.
What? I whispered. What is it you wonder?
Never mind,
he said. He lay down and put one of his thin arms over his bruised-looking eyes.
Just you might think twice about washing away the dirt.
From down the corridor, the one they called Gully bellowed.
There's some here that wants to sleep!
Amy closed his eyes. 4. I lay awake, thinking. The idea that the so-called whole people were protected from the gray at first struck me as racist, right up there with bigoted dimwits saying white people were just naturally smarter than black people. I believed, as I've already said, that those of so-called royal blood put on their pants one leg at a time, just like the unfortunate creatures sweating on the belts to keep the Lord High's lights burning. Only there was genetics to consider, wasn't there? The people of Empus might not know about it, but I did. There could be unfortunate results as bad genes spread, and royal families were good at spreading them. Hemophilia was one. A facial malformation called the Habsburg jaw was another. I'd learned about such things in 8th grade sex ed, of all places. Couldn't there also be a genetic code that provided immunity to the deforming gray? In a normal world, the person in charge would have wanted to save such people, I thought. In this one, the person in charge, Flight Killer, a name that didn't exactly inspire feelings of safety and security, wanted to kill them. And the gray people probably didn't live long either. Call it a curse or a disease, it was progressive. In the end, who would be left? I guess the night soldiers would be, but who else? Was the Flight Killer surrounded by a cadre of protected followers? If so, who would they rule once the whole people had been eradicated and the gray people had died off? What was the end game? Was there one? Something else. Hamie said the Galleons had ruled Empus for time out of mind, but that family tree has been chopped down. Yet, he'd also seemed to contradict himself. In a way, they still do. Did that mean Flight Killer was of, what, the House of Galleon, like in a royalty-centric George R.R. Martin Game of Thrones novel? That seemed wrong, because Leah had told me, through her horse, of course, that her 4 sisters and 2 brothers were dead. Also, her mother and father, presumably the king and queen. So, who did that leave? Some bastard like Jon Snow in the Thrones books? The crazy hermit somewhere in the woods? I got up and went to the bars of the cell. Down from me, Jaya was standing at the bars of hers. There was a piece of bandage tied crookedly around her forehead, with a bloom of blood seeping through it above her left eye. I whispered,
"You okay?" "Yes. We shouldn't talk, Charlie. This is sleeping time." "I know, but when did the gray come? How long has this Flight Killer been in charge?"
She considered the question. At last, she said,
"I don't know. I was a girl in the Citadel when all that happened."
Not much help. "I was a girl" might have meant 6, 12, or even 18 years of age. I was thinking the gray could have started and the Flight Killer might have come to power around 12 or 14 years ago because of something Mr. Bowditch had said. Cowards bring presents. Like he saw it happening, gave his faves some goodies, helped himself to a shitload of gold pellets, and ran away. Also because of something Dora had said. Radar was little more than a puppy when Mr. Bowditch showed up the last time. The curse had been happening then. Maybe, probably. Plus, just to add to the fun, I didn't even know if Empus years were the same as the ones I knew.
"Sleep, Charlie. It's the only escape we have."
She started to turn away.
"Jaya, wait!"
Across from me, Iota grunted, snorted, and turned over.
"Who was he? Before he turned into Flight Killer, who was he, do you know?"
"Eldon,"
she said.
"Eldon of the Galleon."
I went back to my blanket and lay down on it.
Eldon, I thought. I knew that name. Falada, the horse, speaking for her mistress, had told me that Leah had had 4 sisters and 2 brothers. Leah had seen Robert's poor, crushed body. The other brother was also dead, although she hadn't said how it had happened, or if she had seen his corpse.
The other brother was the one who had always been good to her, Falada said. Falada, who was actually Leah herself.
The other brother was Eldon.
5. 3 days passed. I say three because Percy came 9 times with his cart of half-cooked meat, but it might have been longer. In the gas-jet twilight of Deep Malene, it was impossible to tell. During that time, I tried to put together a history I thought of as the fall of Empis, or the rise of Flight Killer, or the coming of the curse. This was idiotic, based on the tiny scraps of information I had, but it passed the time. Some of the time, anyway. And I did have those scraps, poor as they were. One scrap. Mr. Bowditch spoke of 2 moons rising in the sky, but I had never seen the moons rise. I'd hardly seen them at all. He also spoke of constellations no astronomer of Earth had ever seen. But I had caught only occasional glimpses of the stars. Save for that one ephemeral patch of blue when I had been approaching the sundial, I'd seen little but clouds. In Empis, sky was in short supply. At least now it was. Another scrap. Mr. Bowditch had never mentioned Hannah, and I think he would have. I didn't hear the giant's name until I visited the Googer. It was the third scrap that interested me the most, the one that suggested the most. Mr. Bowditch had talked about what might happen if people from our world discovered the way to Empis, a world no doubt filled with untapped resources, gold being only one of them. Just before he realized he was having a heart attack, he'd said, "Would they," meaning the would-be plunderers from our world, "fear waking the terrible god of that place from its long doze?" Based on the tape, things were already bad in Empis when Mr. Bowditch made his last visit, although Hannah might not yet have been at her post back then. The city of Lillimar was already deserted and perilous, especially at night. Did that mean he knew from personal experience, like a final expedition to get more gold, or only that he'd heard it from sources he trusted, Woody, perhaps? I thought he'd made a final trip for gold and that Hannah hadn't been there. Based on this shaky matchstick foundation, I built a skyscraper of supposition. When Mr. Bowditch made his last visit, the King of Galleon, whose name was probably Jan, and the Queen of Same, name unknown, had already been deposed. At least 5 of their 7 children had been killed. Leah escaped, along with Auntie Claudia, and her uncle, or cousin, I couldn't remember which, Woody. Leah claimed her brother Eldon was also dead, but it was clear that Leah had loved him best. That was straight from the horse's mouth, Wasn't it possible that Leah would prefer to believe Eldon dead than to believe he had become the Flight Killer? Did any sister want to believe her adored brother has become a monster? Wasn't it possible that Eldon had also escaped the Purge, if that's what it had been, and awakened the terrible god of that place from its long doze? I thought that was the most believable of my suppositions because of something Hamey had said. Ever since Flight Killer came back from the Dark Well. That might just be bullshit legend, but what if it wasn't? What if Leah's brother had gone down into the Dark Well, just as I had gone down another Dark Well to get here, either to escape the Purge or on purpose? What if he had gone down as Eldon and come back as the Flight Killer? Possibly the god of the Dark Well was directing him, or perhaps Eldon had been possessed by that god, was that god. An awful thought, but it made a degree of sense, based on the way everyone, gray people and whole people, were being wiped out, most of them slowly and painfully. There were things that didn't fit, but a lot of things that did. And, as I say, it passed the time. There was one question to which I couldn't supposition an answer. What could be done about it? 6. I got to know my fellow prisoners a bit, but because we stayed locked in our cells, it wasn't possible to cultivate what you'd call meaningful relationships. Fremy and Stooks were the comedy duo, although they were more amused by their wit, or what passed for it, than anyone else, including me. Dami was big, but he had that graveyard cough, which got worse when he was lying down. The other black guy, Tom, was much smaller. He had a fantastic singing voice, but only Eris could sweet-talk him into using it. One of his ballads told a story I knew. It was about a little girl who went to visit her grandmother, only to find a wolf wearing Nana's nightgown. The Little Red Riding Hood I remembered had a happy ending, but Tom's version ended with a bleak rhyme. She ran but was caught. All her struggles went for naught. In Deep Malene, happy endings seemed to be in short supply. By the third day, I was beginning to understand the true meaning of stir-crazy. My dungeon colleagues might have been whole ones, but they weren't exactly Mensa candidates. Jaya seemed bright enough, and there was a fellow named Jacka who knew a seemingly inexhaustible supply of riddles, but otherwise their talk was desultory prattle. I did push-ups to keep the blood flowing, and squat thrusts, and ran in place.
"Look at the little prince showing off," I said once.
Iota was a shithead, but I'd developed a liking for him nevertheless. In some ways, he reminded me of my long-gone pal Birdie Bird. Like the Birdman, Iota was right out front with his shitheadedness. And besides, I've always had admiration for good trash talkers. Iota wasn't the best I'd ever known, but he wasn't bad. And although I was still your basic short-timer, I enjoyed winding him up.
"Look at this, Eye,"
I said, and raised my palms down hands to my chest. My knees smacked them.
"Let's see you do that."
"And strain something. Pull a muscle. Give myself a rupture. You'd like that, wouldn't you? Then you could run away from me when the fair one comes."
"Not going to be one," I said. 31's all there's going to be. Flight killer's all out of hole people. Let's see you do this."
I raised my hands almost to chin level and kept slapping them with my knees. My endorphins, although weary, rose to the challenge. A little, anyway.
"You keep doing that, you'll tear your ass in two,"
Burns said. He was the oldest of us, mostly bald. What little hair he had left was gray. That made me laugh, and I had to stop. Hamey was lying on his pallet and chuckling.
"There'll be 32, I said. "If we don't get another one soon, they'll stick in Red Molly. She'll make 32. Bitch'll come back from Cratchy soon enough, and Flight Killer won't want to wait much longer for his entertainment."
"Not her,"
Fremy said.
"Don't ever say her,"
Stooks cried. They wore identical looks of alarm.
"I do say it."
I jumped up on the bars of his cell again and began shaking them. It was his preferred mode of exercise.
"Whole, ain't she? Although that great galoopin' mother of hers fell out of the ugly tree and scraped her fucking face all the way down."
"Wait," I said. A horrible idea had come to me. "You're not going to tell me her mother is..."
"Hannah,"
Hamey said.
"Her who guards the sundial and the treasury.
Although, if you got to the sundial, she must be slacking off on the job. Flight Killer won't like that."
I hardly paid attention. That Hannah had a daughter was amazing to me, mostly because I couldn't begin to imagine who had lain with her to produce offspring.
"Is Red Molly a, you know, a giant?"
"Not like her mother," Amit said from down the corridor. "But she big. She go Cratchy to see her kin, land of the giants, you know. She come back and snap you like a piece of kindling if she get a hold on you. Not me. I fast, she slow. Here's one Jack I don't know. I'm tall when I'm young, short when I'm old. What am I?"
"A candle," Jacka said. "Everyone knows that one, dummy."
I spoke without thinking.
"Here comes a candle to light you to bed. Here comes a chopper to chop off your head."
Silence. Then I said,
"High gods, where did you ever hear that?"
"I don't know. I think my mother used to say it to me when I was small."
"Then your mother was a weirdy woman. Never say it again, it's an ill rhyme.
Down the dank and dripping corridor of Deep Moline, Dami began to cough. And cough. And cough. 7. 2 or 3 days later, guessing here dungeon time was no time, Percy came in to serve us breakfast, and this time it really was breakfast. Sausage links tossed through the bars in fat strings, 9 or 10 to a string. I grabbed mine on the fly. Hamie let his lie on the dirty floor, then picked it up and listlessly brushed at the dirt on the links. He looked at it for a while, then dropped it again. There was a terrible similarity to the way Radar had behaved when she was old and dying. He went back to his pallet, drew his knees up to his chest, and turned to the wall. Across from us, I was squatting by the bars of his cell, eating his string from the middle, going back and forth like he was gobbling an ear of corn. His beard gleamed with grease around his mouth.
"Come on, Hamie," I said.
"Try to eat just one."
"If you won't, fling it in here,"
said Stooks.
"We'll take care of it double quick,"
said Fremmy. Hamie rolled over, sat up, and pulled his string of sausages into his lap. He looked at me.
"Do I have to?"
"You better, useless,"
I said. He was already down to 2 sausages, the ones at either end.
"You know what it means when we get these."
Any residual heat the sausages might have had was gone, and the centers were raw. I thought of a story I'd read on the internet about a guy who'd gone to the hospital complaining of belly pains. The x-ray showed he had a huge tapeworm in his intestines. "From eating undercooked meat," the article said. I tried to forget that, not really possible, and started eating. I had a good idea what breakfast sausages meant. Playtime dead ahead. Percy reversed back up the corridor. I thanked him again. He stopped and beckoned me with one melted hand. I went to the bars. In a hoarse whisper from the teardrop that was now his mouth, he said, I shook my head.
I don't understand.
Then he backed out, pulling his empty cart after him. The door shut. The bolts slammed. I turned to Hamie. He'd managed one of the sausages, bit into a second, gagged, and spit it into his hand. He got up and tossed it into our waste hole. "I don't know what he was trying to tell me," I said. Hamie got our tin drinking cup and rubbed it on the remains of his shirt like a man polishing an apple. Then he sat down on his pallet.
"Come over here."
He patted the blanket. I sat down next to him.
"Now hold still."
He looked around. Fremmy and Stooks had retreated to the far side of their crappy little apartment. Iota was absorbed in his final sausage, making it last. From other cells came sounds of chewing, burping, and smacking. Apparently, deciding we were unobserved, Hamie spread his fingers, which he could do being a whole person, with hands instead of flippers, and ran them into my hair. I recoiled.
Nah, Charlie, hold still.
He dug at my scalp and yanked at my hair. Clouds of dirt showered down. I wasn't embarrassed, exactly. Spend a few days in a cell shitting and pissing in a hole on the floor, and you kind of lose the finer feelings. But it was still appalling to realize how filthy I was. I felt like Charlie Brown's friend Pigpen. Hamie held up the tin cup so I could look at a blurry reflection of myself, like a barber showing you your new haircut, only the cup was dented as well as curved, so it was a little like looking into a funhouse mirror. One part of my face was big, the other small.
"Do you see?"
"See what?" He tilted the cup, and I realized that my hair in front, where Hamie had scrubbed away the dirt, was no longer brown. It had turned blonde. Down here, even with no sun to bleach it, it had turned blonde. I grabbed the cup and held it close to my face. It was hard to tell for sure, but it looked like my eyes had also changed. Instead of the deep brown they'd always been, they seemed to have gone hazel. Hamie cupped the back of my neck and pulled me close to his mouth.
Percy said, "Don't wash your hair."
I pulled back. Hamie stared at me, his own eyes, as brown as mine used to be, wide. Then he pulled me close again.
"Are you the true prince? The one come to save us?"
8. Before I could answer, the door bolts were thrown back. This time it wasn't Percy. It was 4 night soldiers armed with limber sticks. 2 walked ahead, arms outstretched, the cell doors squalling open on either side.
"Time to play,"
one of them yelled in its buzzing insectile voice.
"All kiddies, come out to play."
We left the cells. Aaron, who was not present in this bunch of boogeymen, had taken me to the right. We went to the left, all 31 of us in a double line, like real kiddies going on a field trip. I walked at the end, the only one without a partner. The other 2 night soldiers walked behind me. At first, I thought the muted crackling I was hearing, like low voltage, was my imagination, based on the previous times I'd been touched by the enveloping force that was keeping these horrors alive, but it wasn't. The night soldiers were electric zombies, which I thought would be a hell of a good name for a heavy metal group. Hamie was walking with Iota, who kept shoulder bumping my skinny cellmate and making him stumble. I meant to say quit it, but what came out of my mouth was,
"Cease that."
I looked back at me, smiling.
"Who died and made you god?"
"Cease," I said. "Why would you tease someone who's your fellow in this vile place?"
That didn't sound like Charlie Reed at all. That kid was a lot more apt to say, "quit fucking around," than what had just come out of my mouth. Yet, it was me. And Iota's smile was replaced by a look of puzzled speculation. He gave a British-style salute, back of one big hand to his low forehead, and said,
"Sir, yes, sir. Let's see how much you order me around with a mouthful of dirt."
Then he faced forward again.